How you doing? I'll start by saying when we started this process out, Eduardo was adamant that we begin to look at some really good research to fill out this session. And I always thought that much of what we did in this section, a lot of it, even though we're activists at our heart, a lot of it was based on very good science. And I am happy to say that during the review process, kicking and screaming, I was roped into reviewing papers, swearing I did not have the time, and I read our winner's paper, and I was blown away. It was quite impressive work. I immediately threw it at my boss, and we started looking at ways in which we could take this work and immediately put it to use. He made some conclusions. His research led in some ways that really exemplified the concept of research to practice. And I am happy that we were able to, I nominated and we were able to award him our first honor. Vinicius Antal, and I hope I got that right, I've been real bad with names this weekend, is a medical epidemiologist in the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. Dr. Antal is trained in pulmonary and occupational environmental medicine. He leads the registry's team at the Division of Toxicology and Health, Human Health Sciences at ATSDR. He oversees activities relating to the Tremolite Asbestos Registry, the World Trade Center Health Registry, the National Amyotrophic Lateral Sclerosis Registry, and the Disaster Rapid Response Registry. His research interests include new imaging techniques for the evaluation of pneumoconiosis and health effects and epidemiology of naturally occurring asbestos and asbestos-formed fibers. Dr. Antal is the author of 27 papers, 84 abstracts in peer-reviewed medical journals, 13 book chapters in the area of respiratory medicine. He participates in manuscript reviews and editorial boards of 20 major medical journals. He's an active member of the American Thoracic Society, and he's currently chair of the Planning Committee of the Occupational and Environmental Health Assembly, and I would hope that we can soon call him one of our sections on as well. And I welcome you to speak. Thank you, Dr. Antal.
Thank you very much, Walter, for your kind words. First of all, I would like to say that I'm very happy to be here being awarded for this important award in the APHA. And I would like to dedicate this award first to my family, to my wife Germania, who has really brought me into the occupational and health field with her passion for workers' health and fighting injustice. And to my daughter Sophie, who is my inspiration now for keep working and producing scientific evidence to help us build a better world for the future generations. And also, I would like to dedicate this to all the workers who lost their lives, who got injured and sick in trying to respond to those tragic events of 9/11. I have no relationships to disclose. And let me start by saying that it's been 11 years now, and I think that those images probably remain very vivid in our memories. Just after 2 hours, the planes hit the Twin Towers, they collapsed. Afterwards, 4 buildings also collapsed, and as much as 32 buildings were severely damaged. This unprecedented disaster took the lives of more than 2,800 people and left hundreds of thousands exposed to environmental contaminants. The dust cloud resulting from the collapse of the Twin Towers engulfed Lower Manhattan. It was like a wall of dust. This dust contained innumerable toxic substances, including soot, asbestos, lead, VOCs, PCBs, dioxins. As an attempt to follow the health of people exposed to these substances, the ATSDR, together with the New York City Department of Health, created the World Trade Center Health Registry. ATSDR supported initially financially this registry. Nowadays, NIOSH does that support. And so far, we have three waves of surveys in the World Trade Center Registry. From September 2003 to November 2004, where more than 71,000 people enrolled. Subsequently, November 2006 to December 2007, and more recently, from June 2011 to February 2012. The World Trade Center Registry includes information on demographic characteristics of enrollees, exposure and respiratory protection, information on symptoms and diseases pre and post 9/11, including respiratory, cardiovascular, digestive, injury, and mental health, and also home damage due to the dust and debris resulting from this disaster. Here's an overview of the major enrollment groups, and we can see the overlap between these groups. The largest group is building occupants and passersby, followed by rescue and recovery workers and residents in Lower Manhattan. Not shown here is a small group of school teachers and students from Lower Manhattan. Now I'll focus this talk on this paper that was published in the American Journal of Industrial Medicine last year. And I'll take this opportunity to acknowledge my co-authors, Laszlo Palos, Yun Chin, Jay Sapp, Robert Brackbill, Jim Cohn, Steve Stellman, and Mark Verfell. Without them, I wouldn't be here, of course. This was a very good collaborative effort, and they were great to work with. The objectives of this research were to describe the use of respiratory protective equipment among World Trade Center rescue and recovery workers, and to evaluate the association between RPE use and respiratory outcomes among rescue and recovery workers. As we can see here, many workers did not use respiratory protection during those chaotic moments. Some first responders only used surgical masks, disposable surgical masks. Others had semi-facial filtering pieces, hopefully N95 or P100 certified, and hopefully NIOSH certified too. Some workers had elastomeric respirators with disposable cartridges, and others had full-face respirators. Our inclusion criteria was rescue and recovery workers for at least one shift working at the pile of debris resulting from the collapse of the buildings, and those who had answered both wave one and wave two surveys. We categorized respiratory protection equipment into four types. Type one, full face respirators. Type two, half face respirators. Type three, disposable masks with N95 and P100 rating. And finally, type four, the common surgical masks that have no rating for respiratory protection. We further categorized the type of respirator used in the most in each of three periods, according to the minimal level of protection across all periods. Let me give you an example. If in 9/11, a worker used a category 3 mask, and he worked in the following periods. In the second period, he wore a type 2 mask, and in the last period, a type 1 mask, which is the most protective. We would categorize his respiratory protection as the minimum, so he would be under type 3. If they had not used respiratory protection in any of those periods, they would be categorized as no protection. So we were most conservative regarding the exposure, and we thought that any exposure could be harmful. Any period without protection could be harmful. We also looked at training, both pre and during the 9/11 events. We also categorized the presence or absence of fit testing and respiratory protective equipment maintenance, including cleaning of the respirators and changing of the cartridges. The health outcomes of interest were shortness of breath, chronic cough, wheezing, upper respiratory symptoms, and we also looked at medical diagnosis, self-reported, of course, of asthma, including rapid airway dysfunction syndrome and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. All of these had to have an onset or worsening after 9/11 and be present up to 30 days before the Wave 2 survey. We performed statistical analysis, including descriptive analysis, but also multivariate logistic regression using as covariates sex, age on 9/11, education, smoking status, training on the use of PPE, worksite affiliation, number of days worked, and dust cloud exposure. Speaking of dust cloud, some people have very severe exposure to the cloud, being completely covered with dust. Now for the results. A total of 9,296 workers met our inclusion criteria. Their mean age was 45 years old. The vast majority were male, and almost two-thirds had some college education. 42% were ever smoking. The exposure about the number of days worked, the mean number of days worked was 51. One-third had very intense exposure to the dust cloud, meaning that they were completely engulfed in the dust and they couldn't see anything. It was completely dark. Almost half of workers were affiliated with firefighters or law enforcement. 11% were volunteers. And we used the volunteers as our comparison group, since we thought that they would be less exposed. In the first period, in 9/11 itself, half of the workers had no respiratory protection at all. And one-third used only disposable surgical masks, which are not rated, again, for respiratory protection. On the second period, half of workers had no respiratory protection or used surgical masks. We can see, let me see if I can use this as a pointer here. We can see that one-third started using type 2 respirators, or the semi-facial elastomeric respirators. On the last period, there's an increase in the use of proper respiratory protection, with almost half using type 2 respirators. As far as respiratory protective equipment training, before 9/11, only 26 had received respiratory protection training, and 35% had received no training at all. And that's to the point of Walters. That's something that we need to really start using this information to try to train our first responders. So why did they not use respirators? So here are the predictors of respiratory protection use. And training was the top predictor in all periods. So if they have trained, they use respirators. In addition, construction workers were more likely to use respiratory protection. Interestingly, on 9/11, firefighters, EMS workers, and law enforcement workers were less likely to use respiratory protection compared to volunteers. And these are the consequences now. The prevalence of respiratory outcomes was as follows: shortness of breath, 30%, wheezing, 23%, chronic cough, 15%, upper respiratory symptoms was the most prevalent complaint with 71%. 15% of workers reported having asthma diagnosed after 9/11 or worsening of asthma after 9/11. This is three times the national estimates. 9% had complaint of COPD. This in the following table will show us the association between respiratory outcomes and use of protective equipment. We can see that in the first column, on the second column, type 1 versus none, those who used full face respirators were less likely to report a respiratory symptom or disease, although only for chronic cough and upper respiratory symptoms this was statistically significant. But given the small sample of workers that actually use type 1 respirators, I guess this is why we're not finding a stronger statistically significant response, although we can see that there is a trend in all of the odds ratios are protective. When we looked at the comparison of type 2 respirators, we see that all odds ratios are protective, and except for asthma, they are all statistically significant, meaning that workers who use these respirators are 70% less likely to report a respiratory symptom or disease. Moving on to type 3, we see that that association is weaker, and although it's still significant for shortness of breath, wheezing, and chronic cough. And for type 4, there's almost no protection, except for a little bit for chronic cough, upper respiratory symptoms, and asthma. If we look at these two tables, 1 and 2, we see that for some respiratory symptoms, there is a nice trend. Here for chronic cough, it goes from 0.52, 73, 70, 81, same for upper respiratory, which means that the more protection they use, the less likely they are to report respiratory symptoms. This is kind of common sense, but this is the first study to demonstrate this impact on a large sample of rescue and recovery workers. And I think this is important information. The analysis was controlled for possible confounders, such as the start date of work at the WTC site, duration of exposure, intensity of dust cloud exposure, smoking, and everything else that we could find that could confound these results. We also find that it's important to characterize the relatively lack of protective effect of non-rated surgical masks. That's the first thing the workers or anyone will get at the Walgreens or the Walmart. It's a mask off of the shelf. That's good for nothing in terms of respiratory protection, basically. That's the message I have to say. And our first responders have to be aware and be trained about this. Of course, as any study that relies on self-reported questionnaire data, we are subject to some limitations, such as selection bias, recall bias, and we think that there may have been some misclassification of the overall respiratory protection level, possibly because of intermittent use of RPE. So we use a period like of several weeks when they report what they use in that period, but they may have taken it out or used it completely in that period. So there may be some misclassification in that case. In conclusion, training, selection, fit testing, and consistent use of RPE should be emphasized among emergency responders. Respirators prove to have a substantial protective effect against respiratory outcomes. And finally, non-respirator disposable masks did not confer similar levels of protection. Thank you very much for your attention. I'll be happy to answer any questions at this point.
We have time for a few questions if we have any. Dorothy and then Walter.
Sure. So volunteers is a category where they didn't have any professional affiliation either with one of those. Let me go back here to the worker category. So they were not firefighters, EMS, law enforcement, construction, sanitation, public agency. So it was like a catch-all category of people who were not affiliated professionally with any of this industries. So. Yes, so that was our... Yes, well, he's asking about the issue that people who had training were more frequently using the respirators. So that's exactly what we found. That was our strongest predictor of respiratory protection use. So we asked, have you been trained in using a respirator before 9/11? Or during 9/11. So we see that 30% of workers did not receive any training at all. And those who did receive training were more likely to say that they didn't have a health condition. So which means that, that they used the respirator. So the workers who used respirators had been trained either before or during the event. So there was a massive, and when we see, workers didn't use respirators in the first days, but of course this was a catastrophe. You know, we cannot blame the workers for not using, or I don't think we can blame anyone in this case because there was chaos. And a lot of preparedness started to build in this country following 9/11. And I bet that today we're much more prepared because of that. And what happens is they didn't actually have any respirators to use. It's not because they didn't want to. There was no. So in the following days, in 9/12 and so forth, FEMA, OSHA, and everyone started to bring respirators to the scene. But still, those who were not prepared to use, who were not trained, they could not use because they could not just fit the pieces together because they didn't know how to. So that made a big difference in terms of who was using respirators, if they were trained to do that, and if they were fit tested. So I think that's very important to emphasize. Thanks for your question.
One more. I'll get the other two, and that's it. That's some more. Tom, and then John.
Yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. So he's asking about the effect of misclassification if workers did not, if they were supposed to be working like a firefighter, they would be more inclined to say that he used respiratory protection. because of his profession and you know, what the effect it had in our analysis, and in his pointing out that it would be to underestimate the effect, and you're absolutely right. So it may be that the association is even stronger if we had all the correct answers. If someone who didn't use said that they didn't use, so we would have even stronger associations.
One more, John left.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, yeah, that's a very, his, didn't everyone hear the, okay, he was commenting on the oil spill workers, allegedly were told not to wear respiratory protection because it was a bad visual, so, and he's asking me to comment on the liability issues. Well, you know, it's a difficult question, but I guess that if they become sick as a result of that, and if that's proven by a study or by a NOC doc who can make the link between exposure and disease, they would certainly be entitled to claim compensation for that. And that's, I'll have to stop there because I cannot tell you more about the... Well, I think it again, it depends on the intensity of the exposure and the and disease. You have to weigh the two and see what is the outcome would be.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.